Access number 30,001, Mr. Peter Est, Real 19. Now, so what was the squadron flying at the time? Because it's a new Spitfire, isn't it? And I'd like
yes.
to take us through, because you know, you're quite an expert on
Well, when I joined them, they had Spitfire Mark 7s, and they were specially adopted in various ways for high altitude flying. They had a different engine to the average Spitfire. They had with a two-stage blower to give you more power at altitude. They also had elongated wingtips to give you a bigger wing area, which you needed at high altitude to give you same maneuverability.
Or bite or control.
Yeah, it was extended. I suppose each wingtip. Each wing was extended by about 18 inches, 2 feet, something of that sort.
But that made a difference.
Oh, yes, gives you quite a lot more lift. And at high altitude, where the air is that much rarer, it was quite important. And it gave you greater manoeuvrability and control, not so much manoeuvrability as control, at high altitude. Because we used to patrol at about 35,000 feet, and sometimes go up to 40. Excuse me. We used to patrol in pairs over the. You see, this was in not all that long before D-Day. It was about May time, if I remember right.
Well, yes. What was the There's a couple of other things about the Spitfire. Can you talk a bit more about the they had this sort of ceiling, didn't they, on the cockpit? Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Oh yes, the cockpit was pressurised. So when you pulled the canopy to, there was a seal around where the canopy joined the. The front part. Anyway, where the join was, there was a seal, and then you could apply the pressurization, and that would inflate this seal and make it much better for high altitude work.
Did that make it better? I mean, did this work?
It didn't improve the performance of the aircraft.
Oh, no, I mean, more comfortable for you.
Oh, yes, easier. Yes. Much more comfortable, yeah. Especially at high altitude. We see, we used to patrol for an hour at a time.
Now, what was the purpose of the unit? What was the unit's role?
Well, we were basically a fighter squadron, but we were the only one with the Mark 7s, and we were doing these high altitude patrols over the channel ports and trying to protect the southern half of our country where we were preparing for D-Day from being photographed by these reconnaissance aircraft. And in fact, I got one of them. We went into the sea off Ramsgate.
Before we get to the one you got, how did you do? What was the method of operation?
We used to fly. We were under control from the ground at 11 Group headquarters. They had.
That was your group. I should have asked that. 11 Group. Was that
yes. Yes. And they controlled where we went, where we patrolled, and what altitude they wanted us to patrol at. And sometimes on their radar, they would pick up someone coming over, and they said, "We think we've got a." An enemy aircraft coming towards you, keep your eyes skinned, and sometimes we could see them, sometimes we couldn't.
Now you flew in pairs, didn't you? Tell me how that worked.
Yes, well, we used to fly in pairs. We used to fly wide apart. When we got up onto the patrol line, we didn't fly in close formation. We flew probably about 100 yards apart, so that each pilot could keep his eyes skinned for anything that might appear.
So, and tell me about the one you shot down in Ireland. How did that happen?
Well,
what exactly the sort of whole thing to it?
This Messerschmitt 109, obviously doing photographic work. He was on his own at high altitude. And I don't think he expected to find anyone in trying to intercept him at that altitude. We were about 35,000 feet, which for those days was quite a high altitude. We'd been briefed by the ground control room at 11 Group, who said, there's one coming over in your direction. Keep your eyes skinned. They said, we suggest you climb up another 2,000 or 3,000 feet, because we think he'll be coming in a bit lower than that, then you'll be in a better position to attack him if needs be. And that exactly happened. He came over and he didn't expect to be intercepted. Coming over pretty fast and doing a photographic run. Or to do a photographic run, he had to fly straight and level, otherwise his photography or photographs produced wouldn't be worth much.
How did you approach him?
Oh, we attacked him from the rear.
And he never saw you?
He did when we got near him, yes. Yeah, and then he started to try to take evasive action. The two of us there, and I was leading the section, and got the first shots at him, and then the other chap also had a go at him, and then I had another second go at him, and it was after that he went down.
Was he clearly out of control? I mean, you know, there's always this question.
Oh, I think we killed him. I think, and he went straight down. And he went straight into the sea.
Now that was on the 12th of June, 44, according to the book, presumably off the log.
If that's what it says.
Well, you wouldn't remember, I mean, the date or thing like that. Now, I'll come back. Can I talk a bit about the lead-up to D-Day? Because that's what you're doing. You weren't. Do you remember any other particular raids or incidents, combat incidents before D-Day? Or was it quite quiet?
Generally, from now, don't forget we were just on this high altitude interception business all the time. Because they were trying to photograph our preparations for D-Day, and they thought that we were going to take the short journey across the channel from Folkestone and Dover area and go across there. And that's where they were trying to photograph. And of course, on this side of the channel, the Americans and the British would put up a lot of sham stuff, making it look as if hundreds of vehicles and things were being stored there, and of course it was sham stuff they'd built up, and of course the build-up was much further west, because the place of landings were down towards Cherbourg.
So you were in a sense part of the deception as well as stopping the photographing.
Yes.
Now, D-Day itself, it's just in the logbook, very quiet.
Yes, we were when D-Day started. Of course, we were then doing the high altitude patrols over the beachheads, in case there were some of these German reconnaissance aircraft trying to get photographs of all our shipping that was going over, and our build-up for the landings on the beachhead.
But nothing happened?
No.
Not on that wreck down anymore.
No.
And you shot down the one on the 12th, a little bit later. Can I just ask a little about the people in the squadron? Because you were supernumerary at the start, weren't you? But you were...
Yes.
You were soon promoted or
yes.
Or
no, I wasn't promoted. I was already a flight... senior flight lieutenant.
You were made...
But I was made senior flight commander.
What did that mean?
We had two flights in the squadron, A flight and B flight. And I can't remember which one I took over now. I'd have to look at my logbook again. I took over one of the flights anyway. Because I'd had far more experience than the majority of the chaps in the squadron were youngish fellows. Very good chaps, but they hadn't had the operational experience that I'd had.
Now, you were with B Flight.
That B Flight was it, yes.
Now, were there any particular characters you remember from your flight or from the squadron, you know, that stick out in your mind?
Yes, one or two. I had one good friend who was in my flight. His name was Max Charlesworth.
And what rank was he?
He was a flying officer when I joined the squadron, but then he was promoted to flight lieutenant.
And what was Max Charlesworth like?
He was had a bright personality. It was a lot of fun. I liked him very much.
Good pilot?
Yes, he was. And then there was another chap named Johnny Melia. He was a good chap too. I always remember him because he had massive birthmarks all over his face.
All the red
blotches. Mm.
And a good pilot?
Yes. Who else do we have?
And he was the first pilot killed in...
And meteors.
Later on.
Yeah.
Anyone else come to mind? I think Cliff Gray was A flight.
Oh, Cliff Gray was the other flight commander.
What was he like?
Oh, he's a good chap. Yeah. But he was quite tall and completely bald. And didn't have a hair on his head. I don't know how he lost his hair, I'm sure, but... Anyway, it didn't interfere with his ability, and he was a very good chap. So we had a good squadron there, and then we had some NCO pilots as well. And
any of them you remember?
Yes, we had an Australian, a New Zealander, had a couple of Australians.
Did they fit in well?
Oh, very well. Yes. Oh, one was named Mo. We called him Mo. Can't think of his surname. And of course, they used to wear the Australian uniform, which was a dark blue, rather not like our light blue. And I'd have to look at some of the photographs to remember a few more of the personalities, but it was a good squadron throughout.
What was your accommodation like there?
At Bradwell Bay, Nissen huts.
Was it divided into?
Oh yes, so I had my own room.
How big?
About half the size of this room.
Oh, not big then. About 8 by 5. 9 by 5.
A bit bigger than that. I think about 10 feet by 8 feet, something like that.
What would you have in there? Not much room for furniture.
Oh, you had your bed, a chest of drawers, and for all our ablutions and washing, we had to go to a separate hut.
What about the food there?
Well, food was quite good, yes.
And what was your sort of daily routine like? I mean, how often would you go on patrols? Or what would you do when you weren't?
Well, you might have time off, or you might be on readiness to go off again.
And what would be ready? What was the readiness state?
Well, there were various states. There was immediate readiness, when you could go off straight away, or then you might be on half an hour, and then you'd be on, that would be, wouldn't be readiness, that would be sort of standby, really. But you always had to be around and ready. So if the people on readiness were told to get airborne, then the people at half an hour would then become the readiness group, and it would go up the scale.
And would they actually have scrambles, or were you? Because it'd take a long time to get to 30,000 feet. So your book makes reference to
yes,
you'd almost patrol like the old days.
Yes, Yes. Oh, we used to patrol very often, of course. We'd climb up through cloud and we'd be above cloud. So we had to be under the control of the 11 group controller, who would tell us where to go and which course to fly and so on, and which height to go to. Because very often, you know, having gone through a lot of cloud, you couldn't see the ground.
What I mean is, if, even if you were on readiness and took off from the ground, you wouldn't be up there in time for, to intercept anymore, would you? You had to be up there already.
Well, we were on standing patrols all day. So we had in pairs. So we weren't very often have to scramble quickly, because we always had two on patrol, and they wouldn't come down until they'd been relieved by another two. So throughout the whole of the daylight hours, you'd have two going up and down wherever the group wanted us to patrol.
Now, after D-Day, did you start doing, you seem to have started doing more ground operations. Did you do ground strafing and the rest of it operation? Did you do them before, or did that just start after D-Day?
We did do a few ground strafing jobs, but not many. I can't remember without looking in my logbook.
Now, we've just got your logbook, and you're saying after D-Day you were doing the same sorts of patrols on the sort of Channel Port area.
Yes. Dover, Dungeness, Northforeland, Boulogne, those sort of areas. Then on the 11th, I'd already done a patrol over Northforeland and Boulogne for an hour and a half. Then on the that same day, the 11th, we did what they called a rodeo, which was a sweeping whole squadron. Would go over. We went to Brussels, and we did on this one. We did a bit of air to ground. Nothing seen in the airborne, but destroyed a car on the ground.
So this is a what would, now? Take me through a typical rodeo, or that one, if you remember. Is it rodeo?
Rodeo.
Yes, as in the. How did it work? I mean, would you fly over at low level and stay low, or would you?
Yes.
So what would you do?
If we saw any ground target, anything moving, we'd have a go at it. And this particular day, there wasn't a great deal moving. Not military movements, anyway. And so we had a go at something. A private car, I think.
Would you get much coming back at you? Or were you too low?
You could do. Oh, yes. If there were military vehicles on the ground with full of troops, they would certainly come back at you. But then after that, on the 12th, two trips on the 12th, back on our sort of patrols again.
And that's where you shot something, the ME-109 down the 12th.
Yes, that's right. Patrolled Great Cape Greeny, Northforeland, and destroyed an ME with flight. Oh, it's Jesse Hibbert was another man in the squadron, and he was flying with me that day as my number two. And he was a good chap. went into the sea 20 miles east of Northforeland. The pilot bailed out. So it was.
So he wasn't dead?
No, I don't know. I suppose I must have picked him up. There's a little bit in the paper here, high flyer in the sea. An ME-109 which flew high off the south coast last evening was shot down into the sea by Spitfires, which chased it 26,000 feet to 18,000 feet to make a kill. The pilot bailed out. Then back on patrol, it was on the 12th, and we were back on patrol. I did another trip after that one on the 12th. Patrol Calais, Northforeland. We saw the SA Rescue launches looking for the Hun pilot. I don't know if they picked him up or not. The next couple of days, same sort of patrol. Then on the 17th, we did a type of operation when they're called a ramrod.
Now, what's a ramrod operation?
We're doing close escorts to 15 Dakotas to the landing strip on the beachhead.
do you remember of that?
I just remember there's plenty of activity on the ground. Apart from that, I haven't got much.
How far above them would you fly? I think you'd be above them, I presume. You wouldn't fly with them.
Oh, yes, you'd be some each side and some on top.
How far on top?
Oh, about 1,000 feet above.
And they weren't attacked?
No.
What date was that, the Ramrod?
17th of June.
Was Ramrod just meaning escort?
It was a code name.
But was it for escort operations generally, or...?
Yes, Ramrod, yes. You see, then the next day, the second trip that day was not back to the patrol again, Calais Dungeness. Then the next day, did another patrol, Cap Grigny, and to the Thames Estuary. Then I was away for 10 days. I must have had some bit of leave, because from the 18th to the 28th, I didn't fly. So on the 28th, I did another ramrod. We did a sweep behind Lille, escorting Lancasters who were bombing what we call no-balls. The no-ball sites were the launch sites for the V1s.
What do you remember of that? I mean, could you see the V1s?
No, couldn't. Well, yes, if they were on the ramp.
Sights, I mean.
Oh, yes, see the sights. Oh, yes, because they had huge ramps.
And what day was the Lancaster raid on the V1 side?
The 28th of June.
Was their raid successful, from what you could see?
Yes, I saw a few Spitfires and quite a lot of flak over the target area. So the ones who had the Spitfires around the same time.
Did you see much sign of damage done?
No German
aircraft.
Difficult. You see, these ramps, some of the bombs wouldn't hit them direct, perhaps, but they might be near enough to do some damage. So, but you couldn't see that from high above.
How much flak coming up? Much flak anti aircraft coming up? Were the V1s?
Oh, no, they used to aim at the Lancasters.
Not at you?
No.
Now, the book implies that you were more nervous of anti aircraft fire after you'd been shot down in the desert. On the other hand, it only mentions that once.
Yes.
And I'm not sure that it means it, because later on it refers to you several times going into flak without seeming worried about it.
Yes.
How did it change your attitude? What did you feel about anti-aircraft? Were you more worried?
No. Because in the desert, it was a different type of operation.
So as far as you're concerned, anti-aircraft fire was not something you worried
about?
Well,
it depends what height you were. I mean, if you're a very high altitude, you'd be unlucky to be hit. You could go through, you could see them bursting around.
What about low down?
Low down, because you come into the medium, either possibly machine gun fire if you were really low, or the medium flak. But
is that more nerve-wracking? Or was it...
Yes, because you couldn't see it coming. Whereas with the heavy ACAC, you could see it bursting. There'd be a black cloud.
But it didn't sound like you were more nervous than you had been to me, anyway.
No.
So it got the wrong end of the stick in that particular line in the book.
What did he say?
It's just that you were more nervous after you'd been shot down of anti-aircraft fire.
No, it wasn't quite true. No.
I think he's just picked that up from, obviously, yes, a throwaway remark.
Yes, yeah.
Okay, so as far as you were concerned, you were fine.
Yeah.
What's next then? So, any other...
Then, on the 28th of June...
Same day.
We did the ramrod behind Lille for Lancasters, bombing no-balls. And then... we had to go to Hendon to escort a Dakota from Hendon to Bridgewater, and the King George VI was on it.
So he had his own escort then?
Yep. Oh yes. Then the next day, 29th, we did a sweep, Ramrod, sweep to Lille, to support Lancaster's bombing Noble again. Yeah. On the 30th, did close escort to 250 Halifaxes and Lancasters bombing Villa Bocage. Oh, that was a big area behind the where the landings took place in Normandy. There was a big forest area called Villa Bocage, and it was loaded, all intense sort of trees and rather forest area. And it was full of German vehicles, and they'd sort of gone into this area to hide themselves. And I got here, very intense, heavy flak was put up against the bombers. We were escorting 250 Halifaxes and Lancasters because they were going to bomb this whole area of forest area to hell. And the bombing was most impressive, but I saw three bombers go down in flames.
Now, so what happens next? I mean, this seems to be the pattern now. You're on a mixture of close escorts,
yes,
bombers,
yes,
strafing raids.
And as the troops move forward a bit, because there wasn't quite the necessity to do these standing patrols at high altitude, looking for photographic aircraft, because they weren't. They realised then that all the close channel ports were not being used, and that the invasion had already taken place further west.
And now, was that why you got a different Spitfire? Because you weren't doing the high altitude stuff.
Now, we hadn't got different Spitfires yet. We got them fairly soon after we got the Spitfire Mark 9 about mid July, about 6 weeks after D-Day.
So anything else before you got that?
But before I did some more trips, July the 2nd, ran a close escort to 120 Lancasters bombing Noble targets again. A small amount of heavy flak was fired at the bombers. No enemy aircraft seen. Good bombing. 2 days later, on the 4th, close escort to 200 Halifaxes and Lancasters bombing Nobles again. They were a medium amount of heavy flak fired at the bombers. Good bombing. The next day we patrolled North Foreland.
So back to the old routine.
Yes. Yes. We were supposed to escort 48 Mitchells to Chartres, but the show was cancelled. It was only airborne. It was 30 minutes, so they recalled us. And we went to Tangmere to do that. Went from Brabourne to Tangmere, and then we landed at Tangmere and then flew back from Tangmere to Bradwell. 30 minutes flight. Then the next day we did a scramble to 20,000 feet over North Foreland. Only 25 minute trip. The next day, on 2 days later, scrambled to 22,000 feet with a dusk patrol. We were only on patrol for about 40 minutes, 30 minutes of which was night flying. We landed back at night.
Did you do? You still weren't doing much night flying?
No. Then we got, did another trip. I did a trip on a Mark 9, did a cannon test on the 15th, but then on the 16th I was back on the 7, did a scramble to the Dutch Islands to escort a shot up Liberator back home. Then we got the 9s, and we were doing